Before we get started, I just wanted to let you all know that there is a new website for the podcast. It's www.cultvaultpodcast.com, where you can find recent episodes, blog posts from cult survivors, and places to sign up for exclusive content starting at only £1 a week at sites like patreon.com/thecultvault. There's also the option to subscribe to my monthly newsletter, where you can find out all about upcoming content. And again, I've been very lucky to have received some recent sponsorships, so as much as I would love to avoid putting ads in the episodes, I hope you don't mind listening to a few here and there so I can make some pennies to keep creating this content. Hello listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. This week I have something new and exciting. I am interviewing linguist and feminist author Amanda Montell. I hope you enjoy hearing about her upcoming book release as much as I did. Of course, it is still all things cultish. So, hello, Amanda, and welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is something a little bit different to what the listeners will be used to, but it's going to be exciting, especially for me, nevertheless. So we're going to be discussing a book rather than a specific cult or group. Would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Of course. So thank you so much for having me here to discuss my favorite topic, cults. My name is Amanda Montell, and I'm the author of two books. The latest is Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism, which is about the language of cults from Scientology all the way to SoulCycle. My background is in linguistics, and this is sort of a pop linguistics meets sociology, meets psychology, meets just like juicy investigative book about how cultish leaders from Jim Jones to Jeff Bezos to Instagram influencers use language as their ultimate form of power. And I'm also the author of a book called Word Slut, A Feminist Guide to Taking Back the English Language, which is available now wherever books are sold. And Cultish comes out this summer in the US. It comes out June 15th, and in the UK, it'll be out in July. So I've spent the past 2 years thinking about nothing but cults of all stripes.
That's absolutely amazing. Just to have... you're quite young as well to have two books already, well, all I would say already published, because I know that a few lucky people have received a copy of Cultish already, even though it's not released.
Oh yeah, well, the advanced galley copies are circulating about, and those always make me cringe because they're like the uncorrected proofs. So there are like little changes in them that will not be in the final version and stuff like that. So yes, people are reading a version of Cultish right now, that's totally fine and exciting, and people are really enjoying it. And
amazing.
Really excited for the launch. So
is it interesting getting feedback on something so early?
Well, it doesn't feel early to me, I guess, because I've been with the material for 2 years, you know, and I'm not one of those writers who has like a writer's group or like a ton of people constantly reading their work. I had my editor read it and I had my brother read it, and was it for 2 years. So I'm speechless, clearly. It's thrilling having people read this thing that has just been so secret and private for so long, like me on an island quarantining and like typing away about this topic. It's amazing when it's actually in the world and people are consuming mm-hmm. it, and it's especially amazing when people are loving it. So
yeah, and has your brother developed a newfound or maybe already had an interest in cults and all things cultish?
Yes. Well, I think we both sort of grew up with an interest in cultish groups because my dad was forced to join a notorious cult in the San Francisco area when he was in his teenage years. And so we grew up on those riveting stories. I don't know if this is a cult that you've covered, but it's called Synanon.
Yes, I have covered Synanon and the troubled teen industry quite extensively, yeah.
Yeah, so my dad, it was 1969, and my dad had up until that point, he was 14, and up until that point he had lived with his single, extremely mentally ill mother in New York City. And that became, an unsustainable life. They were very, very poor, and ultimately he made the decision to move in with his dad instead. His dad was this like absentee father. He's a card-carrying communist, very interesting figure. And he had like a whole replacement family. So my dad had a new stepmom and two new toddler-age half-sisters, and he basically moved across the country in search of a better life. But then very quickly, my dad's dad moved the whole family onto Synanon. And so my dad went from the frying pan into the fire, from like being destitute in, Spanish Harlem, New York as a young kid, to being in like one of the most notorious cults of all time.
That is absolutely fascinating. He must have some stories to tell. Oh my goodness.
Well, my dad is like such an animated storyteller, and I think part of my love of nonfiction was inspired by just growing up on the stories from his childhood. And he was always like so generous with the storytelling. And I grew up on stories of the Synanon game, and the fact that he would escape actually every single day to attend a normal school in San Francisco, even though that was prohibited. Most kids had to attend the Synanon school, which of course was this unaccredited like quack bullshit. Like, it wasn't really a school. But he had lived in New York City his whole life. He was like, this is a cult. I'm not gonna let this influence me. And so he stayed skeptical, laid really low, hitched a ride into San Francisco every single day to attend a regular accredited high school so that he could escape and go to college. He had a very unique experience there. He also ran the Synanon microbiology lab at the age of like 15, 16. He met a scientist at Synanon who tasked him with running the lab with him. And so while his peers on the outside were like worrying about college applications and like puppy love, he was, culturing cult members' throat swabs and like testing their stool
Gosh.
for tuberculosis or whatever. Like, I guess you wouldn't test stool for tuberculosis. It goes to show how much I know about microbiology. But then, that is ironically where my dad developed his love of science. And now, both my parents are these like acclaimed research scientists.
Oh
So
my goodness.
it's a wild story.
That sounds so wild. I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all that you were more interested in nonfiction growing up, because your dad's stories are almost unbelievable to, like, if you didn't know about Synanon, and if any of the listeners aren't sure about Synanon, then you should definitely go back to the earlier episodes and check it out, because it's such a wild ride.
So yes, no, as you were saying, Synanon, it was a bad place for kids. And I'll just say this, my two aunts, my dad's half sisters, who spent like their early childhood in Synanon, they're pretty fucked up on that.
Yeah, I did you I mean did you have you collected all the stories to use in have you did you have you looked at Charles Dederick specifically in the book Cultish?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I don't focus on, I, well, okay, I'll say this. My book is basically structured by into these six different parts, and each part of the book is dedicated to a different category of cult. So the first part of the book is just establishing really the language that we use to talk about cults, because there are so many myths surrounding what a cult even is, and essentially establishing that, like, our prevailing wisdom about cult influence and brainwashing and mind control is quite pseudoscientific and mythologized. What's really going on are these methods of conversion, conditioning, and coercion that have everything to do with language. So I sort of established that in the first part of the book. And then for the following five parts of the book, I focus on these different categories of cults, starting with the most notorious and destructive groups like Jonestown and Heaven's Gate, moving on to religious cults like Scientology, Children of God, The Way International, and then sort of moving toward groups that are cultish, certainly on the cult spectrum, but groups that, you know, imbue our everyday lives, like multi-level marketing companies and pyramid schemes, then moving on to cult fitness, SoulCycle, CrossFit, Peloton, and then finally ending with social media cults and Instagram gurus and that sort of thing. All the while showing how these different elements of cultish language, and this is sort of this double entendre, because the book is called cultish, not only because can all of the groups along the cult spectrum can be described as cultish, but also because cultish is the name of this cult language that I describe, you know, like English, Spanish, Turkish, cultish. And all of these leaders, from those as notorious as Chuck Diederich, but also SoulCycle instructors and spiritual influencers on social media, use these varying techniques. And when you understand what the language of cultish sounds like, you won't be able to unhear it in your everyday life. So I do talk about Chuck Diederich a bunch in the book, but I sort of weave my dad's stories throughout the entire manuscript, because they're such a fixture in my understanding of cults, and they were kind of a reference point for me, because I grew up on these stories, and because I'm a word nerd and I see the world through a language lens, the most interesting parts about my dad's Synanon stories were the way that the group used language, talking about, you know, how there were all these acronyms and special buzzwords, like teachers were called demonstrators, and there were PODs, or parents on duty, the like adults that were assigned to keep an eye on the children's barracks. And there was this thought terminating cliche, this semantic stop sign, if you will. This is an element of cult language that I talk about in the book. This phrase that was always repeated in Synanon to get people not to question any of their protocols. The phrase was "act as if," and it essentially meant, you know, you might be familiar with it. If you questioned or had a concern or a doubt or about one of the totally arbitrary, bizarre, and often destructive rules in Synanon, someone would just say, "Oh, act as if," which meant the solution is to act as if you agree with this until you do. Mm-hmm. And that sounds batshit to outsiders, I'm sure, but these varying methods of conversion, conditioning, and coercion made this language, or language was the means through which like this manipulation occurred, and everything made sense. And it's fun to learn a secret code language that nobody else can understand. And it contributes to creating a culture of shared understanding, so that, you know, the people in the group have a sense of solidarity and an us-them mentality, and this language can encourage confirmation bias and, you know, logic flaws that basically prevent people from seeing that the group they're in is actually really dangerous. So
it sounds so interesting. You must have had just some really interesting moments over the last 2 years where you've read something or researched something, and you know how these things, as I always find, especially when interviewing people, I could be an ex-Scientologist or an ex-Jehovah's Witness, just it's like a big dot to dot picture, and it all connects and it all links up. So you must have had so many of those moments.
Oh yeah, and people tend to be mind blown when a certain group reminds them of another, but it's like all these cults are the same. Like they all, especially the really destructive ones or the new age ones or whatever, like they all use the same exact strategies. And whenever a cult documentary comes out, we're always shocked that these people were able to be quote unquote brainwashed or like mind controlled or, you know, stuck around this group for so long. But there's a science to it. Like there is a social science of cult influence. And it's something that like few people have analyzed in public, at least in a way that's accessible. And so like the whole book is basically dedicated to, you know, answering this question, like, why do people join these fanatical fringe groups? Why do they stay? Could it happen to me? It's like, to some degree, it already has, because we're all involved in a cultish group of some kind. And we're all under this linguistic manipulation in one way or another. And so, you know, sometimes when we think about cult followers, we create an us them dichotomy. We're like, oh, they're desperate, they're stupid, they're disturbed, they're naive. Absolutely. But those are myths. And so I talk a lot in the book about some of the truths that varying experts had to offer about the type of person who's most likely to get involved in a group like Synanon or Scientology. And certainly there are those who are born into them. But one of the most interesting sources that I interviewed for the book was a Jonestown survivor, this woman named Laura Johnston Cole. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she was able to evade the massacre that day because she was one of a lucky few to be sent to Guyana's capital that day. So she wasn't even in Jonestown on the day of the massacre. She was there as like a welcoming committee for Congressman Leo Ryan. I don't know how many people know the whole story of Jonestown, but she escaped the Jonestown massacre. That's what we need to know. And then you'd think, and she was someone who was incredibly bright, really optimistic, college educated. She'd been an anti-racist activist her whole life. And she just, you know, had this idealist communalist mentality where she was just like, yes, I, and not to mention Jim Jones, like, was a master orator. So he was really able to connect with her and all of his individual followers. But she did not fit the stereotype of someone desperate and disturbed who would join a cult. But even so, you'd think like, okay, she escaped one of the most epic cult tragedies, if not the most epic cult tragedy in human history, depending on your definition of cult, by the way, because the boundaries between religion, cult, and culture are pretty permeable. But anyways, you'd think like, okay, she escaped Jonestown. This lady's probably done with cults for life, right? But no, she went ahead and almost immediately joined up with Synanon. So she and my dad did not overlap during their time there, but that was a pretty epic coincidence that this Jonestown survivor that I reached out to ended up also being a member of Synanon. And she sent me a list of like the glossary of terms that she remembered from back in the day. And I like cross compared it with my dad's glossary of terms from Synanon. It was really interesting. So yeah, countless fascinating conversations for the book for sure.
Oh my goodness. And I think one of the things I think is really exciting about the work that you've been doing is there's a lot of academic research available from professionals in the field. But I think sometimes the heavy academic readings can put people off of learning about these things and learning that it's not people like quote unquote stupid people or people who have, you know, low self-esteem or are easy to manipulate that are the ones that will be targeted for cults. And actually anybody can be drawn into one of these types of groups or movements. So your book, I think, comes from a place of being accessible for people who might not want to sit down and read like really heavily academic stuff with language in it that you have to read that same sentence over and over and over because it's just not, there's too many big words in it and it's just not going in. So it's almost coming from like you said, sort of like a pop culture meets academia kind of in the middle, really, really nicely accessible for people that want to learn more about cults, but don't necessarily, you know, want to read the PhD exactly. Kind of really heavy stuff. So I think that's one of the things.
I'm going to talk to all these academics like Eileen Barker and Rebecca Moore and like all these people. And then I'm going to curate the information and make it feel juicy because I'm not an academic. Like, I'm a literary writer. I have a background in linguistics and I come from a long line of academics, but I myself am a creative writer. And the whole challenge and the fun part of the books that I write is that I'm basically trying to take this academic subject that can be quite dry, but that I think is inherently so fascinating and has so much to do with human nature. And it's something that we all want to know about, but that is often in, you know, popular media covered in a really pseudoscientific or unsatisfying way. And it's my like job and my thing to take this information and make it like juicy and riveting and digestible and funny at times. And so that's like my whole
Yeah, career. Yeah. And you've just summed it up. Like, I was trying to get my point across, and I just go, like, all my listeners will know this, I just go around about and around about, and I never get to the point.
No, you got it. You summed it up. No, that's exactly that's the mission. So,
well, one of the questions I did have, and I suppose this is still fresh in your mind, is what is your process when it comes to writing? I mean, do you do all your research first, or do you do research as you go? Do you make notes? Do you have like organized journals, or just scrap pieces of paper all over the place? How does it work?
Great question. Everybody works so differently. Like, I think people who maybe come from a more academic background, or who have a master's degree, or I don't know, are slightly like more organized, perhaps, they do all their research first and then they start writing. But the research part is like not my favorite part. The writing is my favorite part. So I research and write as I go, which maybe isn't as efficient, but I'm also a pretty quick writer at this point, so it works for me. But for this book, what I did was I, you know, there's very little academia on the language of cults. There's, you know, a fair amount on the psychology of cults, the sociology of cults, but not too much on the language of cults. It's kind of a new idea. And so there are definitely a ton of academic studies in the book that are related to my thesis, but there was nothing that I was just like, oh, this is perfect, which made me feel good, because I was like, oh, this is a very original idea. So mostly what I did was conduct original interviews. You know, I conducted upwards of probably 100 different interviews with various cult, and that's in scare quotes, followers, ex-followers, sociologists, linguists, psychologists, religious studies scholars, you know, so many different people. And I would, you know, get the interviews transcribed. And then I came to the project with an existing proposal. Like, that's how nonfiction books are sold. Okay. A little publishing industry insight. You don't have to write the whole book before a publisher invests in you. You basically sell the book based on a proposal. So I had already basically outlined the structure of the book and the thesis. And that's the most important thing a publisher needs to know in order to invest in the book. So I had something to go on. But of course, as you do the research, like, the thesis can really change, and the structure of the book can even change. So before, I mean, when I first set out to write the book, there were gonna be like so many different parts, not just six. I was trying to cover like every single category of cult you could think of, fraternities, sororities, like, oh my God, music, celebrity fandoms, like, it was just way too much. And I realized probably less is more here, because otherwise it's going to read like an unsatisfying textbook, and I don't want that. So yeah, I basically conducted all of these interviews, and then my goal was for it to read almost like a novel. Like, I wanted it to read like a juicy investigative story with like analysis snuck in there. And so, yeah, I got my first Goodreads review the other day, and the person gave me 5 stars. And she said that it felt like, at the same time, reading the like juiciest narrative story and the most interesting textbook at the same time. And I was like, oh, that's so great, because that's like exactly what I wanted to do. But yeah, I mean, obviously there are like so many drafts that get written, and mm-hmm. so many edits. But luckily this was my second time around. So I didn't feel as quite as like lost in the middle of the ocean in terms of like the process of writing the book. But I write it in Google Docs, you know. I have like I have different folders for every part of the book and every chapter, and I have you know, various documents that I use. Like, for me, my books are very thesis driven, so I always have like the core thesis of the book in my mind. And even if I come across something like really, really interesting, I might try to incorporate it, but if it doesn't ultimately serve the core thesis of the book, then I have a document where I put things that I can save for later, like maybe for a piece that I'll write and publish on the internet or something like that. So yeah, it's very much like, what's that funnel analogy where you have to like start really, really wide and just like gather all of the information that you can, and then get really like more perfectionistic and more detailed as you go, and then get wide again at the end to make sure that you have like this bird's eye view and can almost see the book as a reader would for the first time. But you know, it's an arduous process, this book writing thing.
It sounds like so much to juggle. I mean, I'm the type of person that has to usually write things down on paper or read things in a, I've got a Kindle, but I'm not great with my Kindle. I'd rather have the physical book.
Me too.
And it's the same when it comes to sort of organizing or taking notes. When I research for the episodes, I'll watch a documentary or YouTube videos or listen to other people's podcasts and interviews. And instead of typing on my laptop, I'll have my notebook next to me and then I'll type those notes out from the notebook. I don't know.
Oh, but
I did actually find an app the other day. It's called Bookstop. And it's the first thing, I've tried a couple of apps that help you organize and kind of put your things down on and like a little personal planner. But Bookstop is the first app that I've used that actually helps me create like a routine and stick to it. I haven't been able to stick to any of these kind of apps before, but this one, I mean, I get the feeling that this one would be specifically really good for people with ADHD, but anybody who has kind of routine struggles or deadlines to stick to or anything like that, then this app has been the one that's really helped me. Because I don't know if people realize how much goes into making a podcast, but there's like, for the deep dive episodes, there's the research and the scripting and the recording and the editing and the uploading. But then with the interviews, you have to reach out to people, gather information about their experiences, tailor interview questions, sort out time zones, which are just always so difficult for me.
No, it's like, it's the whole production.
It is.
Yeah,
it
I'm is. Actually... I just this morning, I'm in the process of launching a podcast now too.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I'm doing it with a friend, with a comedy friend of mine. It's called Sounds Like a Cult, and it's also a cult podcast, but slightly different angle. Basically every week she and I are going to pick a different like fanatical fringe group that exists in like pop culture or the internet.
Yeah.
Try to figure out like, this group sounds like a cult, but is it really? And if so, how bad is it? So things like SoulCycle, essential oils, MLMs, astrology, like things like that. So it's like slightly more lighthearted. There are lighthearted parts of my book as well. Like that's just who I am as a person. There's always going to be like dark humor in anything that I do.
A quick message from one of this week's sponsors. This week, we've been supported by Alex Bloom at Disturbed Law. The green-eyed woman has a hunger. She's a young sociopath with a pathological need to kill. The only problem is, each time she satiates this desire, her victims are somehow being reanimated into nightmarish monsters. Follow the episodic animated series available on YouTube today. With short segmented videos, this story is told in a compelling way, with the audio serving all the functions of a brilliantly written audiobook, to the animations that complement this spooky storytelling. Season 1 is available today with 12 short episodes that will answer the questions, who is the green-eyed woman, and who is reanimating her victims? Find out today by visiting www.disturbedlaw.com or find the episodes on YouTube on the Disturbed Law channel.
I just take it really slow. Like people sometimes ask me, how do you self-motivate? You know, how do you stick to deadlines? And first of all, when you have a book contract in place, like that is a big motivator. You know, like I'm not that self-motivated. I do have a publisher who is waiting on a book to be written, but also, you know, I just set my daily expectations for myself really, really low. And I think sometimes people get overwhelmed when they create a to-do list that's just like shooting for the stars, you know, because then you're setting yourself up for disappointment. And I just like take a look at what I have to do and I break it down into really, really bite-sized pieces, and I yep. don't overload my daily to-do list. And something that I think other writers do that works for them is that they have like daily word count goals, but that like doesn't really make sense for me, because I mean, I can see why it makes sense, but I have my daily writing goals have way more to do with the topic. It's like, I'm going to cover like this, you know, this is a point that I need to make in this chapter. I'm going to dedicate Thursday and Friday to writing about this. And maybe that'll only be two paragraphs. Maybe it'll be 5,000 words. But, you know, if I get into the groove of a topic, but I've met my word count like goal for the day, like why would I get out of the groove, you know? Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I address it by topic, and that's how I outline as well, less than word count, and that seems to work for me. I don't know, this is really in the weeds, this discussion now, but you know, productivity is like a real subject of interest in quarantine, especially, I think. So
mm-hmm. yeah. I was gonna ask how the whole pandemic had affected, you know, whether it had a positive or negative effect on your working over the last kind of year, but maybe it's had both effects.
I would say both. Yeah, I mean, in a way, like it's made me extremely productive because I have no excuse to do anything else. But for my mental health, that's kind of bad, because it's like now the only thing that gives my life worth is my book. So if like something having to do with the book doesn't go my way, it's like extra crushing. But in terms of productivity, I think I would say it helped. Something interesting was that there's a part of the book where I talk about cult fitness studios like SoulCycle, etc. And I had started writing that part of the book in April of 2020, like everything was closed. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh shoot, I'm not going to be able to try any of these cult workouts in the studio and get that like firsthand experience. But I absolutely hate exercising. So I was like, oh no, I guess I'm gonna have to do the online version of these workouts. Darn it. But my thesis was that, you know, the most compelling parts of these groups is the language. And so if that thesis holds true, then I should be able to be compelled even through a screen. And I would say that that was true. And I'm not writing about them from my personal like first person perspective mm-hmm, mostly anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's hilarious. Like the podcast episode of my podcast that we recorded this morning is about SoulCycle. And my co-host was just like roasting me because I know so much about SoulCycle. Like I have reported on this company for years because I used to work as a beauty and wellness editor at a magazine. So like I have talked to so many people about SoulCycle. Never in my life been a SoulCycle.
That's so funny. It's interesting though, because I have just recently interviewed two women who were part of multi-level marketing schemes. Mm. So those episodes will be coming out on the podcast soon. And they definitely had some interesting insight to offer to a corner of the world that I think people wouldn't assume immediately on the surface could be described as cultish. But definitely does have aspects of coercion and cult-like methods of control.
Oh, very much. I mean, these companies aren't just companies. They are, first of all, deeply deceptive, like money traps, but they're more than just your average scam. You know, there are these tightly knit, ideologically bound communities whose, you know, aims are missionary in character, whose higher-ups are worshipped on the level of gods. Mm-hmm. And there's so much like interpersonal pressure that it can get extremely cult-like, not to mention in the US, a lot of MLMs are affiliated with different religions. There are a ton of like yes. Christian-backed MLMs or Mormon-backed MLMs. And yes. so a lot of these folks who are being scammed out of thousands and thousands of dollars, driven into financial ruin. I mean, the numbers of MLMs are really shady and really grim, but the language is extremely compelling, so people participate anyway. But yeah, these people who get involved, you know, a lot of the time they see what they're doing as an act that's serving God. Like, they're doing their spiritual and patriotic duty by getting involved with the multi-level marketing industry. That's how it's pitched. So under those kind of promises, things get culty really fast.
Well, even just yesterday, I got invited to a group called Tropic Skincare with so-and-so. And I was thinking, oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of offended that no one ever tries to get me to join their pyramid scheme, but I think I seem pretty incredulous, so people can just like smell it on me that I'm not going to be the right recruit.
Yeah, or you would happily join just to kind of just lurk and get some information on the goings on.
I considered it, and you know, actually, this to bring it all the way back full circle, I mean, I've always been so interested in cult language, even when I was a kid, and I never really saw a sharp distinction between, accepted religion and cults. Like, objectively, they have so very many things in common, and so much of the difference between a cult and a religion is, like, cultural normativity. So I grew up in a family of atheist scientists. I grew up super Reformed Jewish, but you know, I was not exposed to like fanatical supernatural beliefs or communities whatsoever. But my best friend in middle school, her mom was an evangelical Christian who went to one of these mega churches. And sometimes I would accompany them on Sundays to their church, just like as a spy, like anthropologically, I found it so interesting when I was like 12 years old. And again, like the most interesting thing about the place to me was this very distinct dialect of like evangelicalese that they would use. It wasn't like King James Bible English. It was modern and very particular. Like people would say things like such and such was on my heart instead of on my mind. Or they would, you know, redefine a lot of existing English words to have a new, you know, evangelical meaning. Like the word convicted meant to be like moved by the spirit to do something. And there were words like that honestly kind of sound like corporate bullshit, like missional and intentional and all this stuff. And I found that, you know, while this language didn't communicate anything that couldn't be said in plain English, using it was like this key unlocking the group's acceptance. You know, it was a sign that you were an insider. It was like a truth serum to earn their acceptance. It was just like so powerful. So that was like an early lesson in like the power of cultish language to form solidarity or to communicate an ideology or to obscure truths. It really is like such a powerful thing that we take for granted.
I was actually going to ask about your religious affiliation and whether you had any. So you've answered that question for me now. And it is actually today International Atheist Day.
Oh, yeah. I would still identify as an atheist. It's not the sexiest thing in the world to be an atheist, at least not in the US, where atheists and, you know, devil worshipers are still kind of, you know, considered one and the same. But increasingly, you know, our society is becoming in a way less religious, I guess, less traditionally religious. Scholars of religion have come up with titles like the nuns and the remixed nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S, to describe the new way that young people in the United States and probably the UK too are coming to have a relationship with religion. A lot of people are getting their religious fix in spaces like SoulCycle now, or in just alternative ways, which is really interesting and can get cultish pretty fast. So it's really no accident or no coincidence that cults are like such a subject of fascination right now. It's because we're in one of those really intense periods of reckoning in our culture where our trust with mainstream institutions like the government and big business and big pharma and traditional religion is really waning. And so we're like looking to alternative groups to fill the void. And some of those alternative groups are healthy and constructive, and some of them are really unhealthy and really destructive. And so the word cult can really, in a way, work to describe them all.
It's interesting the way you've just summarized it. It gives me the 70s feel when a lot of these groups were formed in the first place because of, you know, things that had happened with them, you know, the like the end of the hippie era and the Vietnam War. And now we're kind of back to that.
It's very similar. And just like now, those, you know, culty folks were, you know, young countercultural people who felt like the powers that be had failed them. It's very, very similar to now. You know, I always say that, like, if you've ever signed up for an astrology app or been to a music festival or followed a, you know, spiritual guru on Instagram, if you were in the 70s, you'd probably have brushed up against a cult of some kind.
Just wanted to take a quick break from this current discussion to talk about one of my sponsors. And I wanted to, instead of recording the segment, I wanted to ask you, are you a fan of true crime?
Oh my God, I'm obsessed with true crime.
Well,
I don't think I know anyone who's obsessed with cults who's not also obsessed with true crime.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting because with the podcast, there's a level of interest in true crime and cults that I have, but then there's also the other side of me that interviews victims and survivors, and those two parts in my mind are very different because one has to kind of have a fascinated approach, but also on the other side have to have a very thoughtful approach because these are real people and their lives. Yeah. And obviously it's one thing to be like, wow, that's amazing, but it's also another thing to be like, oh my goodness, that's your life. But the reason I ask is because this week's sponsor is Taction USA, and they sell on their Amazon and their website, TactionUSA.com, forensic equipment for CSI workers and people in law enforcement. They offer prime shopping and allow people to buy in any quantity at very competitive prices, not like other forensic suppliers who demand that you buy in bulk and wait ages to receive your product. But the really exciting thing about this that I wanted to bring to you, Amanda, and ask you about is, if you're a fan of true crime, do you think in your echo chamber that there are people who you associate with who are also fans of true crime?
Oh my God, all my friends are obsessed with true crime.
Because you can go on this website and you can buy your friends, like, for birthdays or Christmas or just like a little gift for them, you can go onto Taction USA and you can get them like forensic testing kits and like equipment for testing DNA and things like that. And for somebody like me who is never going to be able to study in the field of forensic anthropology like I really wanted to many years ago, when I got given this sponsor, I just thought, how exciting would it be to be able to buy a friend something like that from a website that seems like so, like, it seems inaccessible for somebody like me, just a Jane Doe. I'm just gonna go on this website and buy myself like this really awesome roll of caution tape. I don't know, it's just really interesting. So I just wanted
that
to bring
like a good website for like a Halloween party.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing. And I think the work that they're doing is really good. It's not just for, you know, not just for fans of true crime like you and I, but also for those CSI workers and for those law enforcement workers. And so that's anybody that's interested, you should definitely check out their website. And of course, they are sponsoring this episode as well, so I'm very lucky to be in touch with them. That's Taction USA, TACTION USA, and their website is TactionUSA.com. So definitely go and have a look, because if you're struggling for gift ideas, I promise that after going and having a look on their website, you'll be stuck for choice.
Oh my God. So funny. What a world. Do you aspire to be an armchair forensic scientist? There's a website for you.
There we go. That's it. That's the start of the ad. Perfect.
That is so funny.
Just to go back to our discussion, there was something I wanted to quickly ask about your other book, Word Slot, before kind of getting into the last few questions around cultish. And there's a little line at the very start of the book that mentions that there's a specific reason why American people enjoy English accents so much. And so many people I speak to who are like, oh my goodness, you're from England, your accent's so cool. I just wondered if you knew what the answer was to that question and if you could just let me know what it was.
Oh yeah, it's in the footnote. It's in the footnote.
Is it?
In the book, yeah. Well, in part, it's just a fetish for the exotic. We as speakers like an accent that's a little bit different, particularly one that holds this fake made up thing called prestige. And so much of the prestige of a British accent exists for us Americans because we have like a set of mommy issues that colonized countries tend to have for their motherlands. So I have a line in Word Slut where I say that if a bunch of people like settled on from Venus to Mars, then Martians would probably find a Venusian accent super sexy because we just have like mommy issues that cause us to, I don't know, like glorify our motherlands as a colonized nation.
That is so interesting. I mean, from one book to the next, you must have just had such a wealth of knowledge.
I am a smartass, and it is fun to learn things and share them. And, you know, as I keep saying, like, language is my thing. I'm a word nerd. And I'm especially interested in the relationship between language and power. And so the Word Slut is about the relationship between language, gender, and power. And Cultish talks about the relationship between language and power from this cult angle. And I thought it was interesting what you were saying before about how you have to kind of compartmentalize when you talk about, like, when you talk to cult junkies versus cult survivors. And I think like you can hold those two perspectives in your mind at the same time, because I think, you know, anyone who takes an interest in cults as an outsider is in part like a deeply empathetic person, because you're looking in at these experiences and you're thinking even unconsciously, like, does this group pose a threat to me? Like, that's what rubbernecking is. You know, we see a tragedy or even news of a tragedy, a documentary, a headline, whatever it is, and our brain starts firing these signals that tell us, like, we need to scan for threats. Like, could this happen to me? Like, could I join a group like this? Like, is this a threat to me? And I think, you know, we sometimes, because of the media and because of the way that these groups and these followers are painted in films and stuff like that, we come to think of them as other, and we come to think of them as deficient intellectually or morally or something. But really, like, the aim of my book is not just to tell like a juicy cult tale. It's to show us how like we are all in one way or another susceptible to this type of influence. And that's not to say that just anyone could find themselves like ears deep in a group like the Children of God. Like, it couldn't happen to just anyone. And there are people who literally grew up from birth in these groups who knew from a young age because of instinct, like, there's something wrong here. Like, this isn't right. I need to get out of here. And there are so many, there's such a complicated combination of influences, nature and nurture, that gives us, you know, a sense of skepticism or not. But yeah, I mean, the book ultimately has this very empathetic stance where it's like, I'm showing you that these people are not just brainwashed. There is this systematic pattern of techniques that's used to basically assault the human spirit and our desire for community and connection and ritual and spirituality. And that can sometimes be taken advantage of in a really exploitative way. So yeah, I'm a cult junkie and a cult empathizer cult follower empathizer at the same time.
I think that's a perfect way to sum it up. And I've been struggling with both of those concepts for a while now. And my Patreon coverage is always researched deep dive episodes of things. Like this month, I'm doing Heaven's Gate for the kind of anniversary of the completion of suicide within the group. So I really enjoy the research side of things and finding things out. And, you know, like Marshall Applewhite, where was he born? How did he grow up? How did he develop? And then, you know, like him and Bonnie Nettles, and how did that change? And I find that really interesting. But if I was to speak to somebody who was a member of that group, I think my approach to my questioning them would be completely different than my approach to researching when there isn't somebody's personal kind of, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it's that disassociation that you have where you can watch a documentary about, I don't know, JonBenet Ramsey and be like, oh my goodness, that's so horrible and tragic, but I'm going to binge the documentary because it's fascinating. But if you spoke to one of her family members, that's probably not the way you would describe it or look at it. It's, I don't know.
No, I don't think that there's some like dark, twisted voyeur in all of us that's like secretly obsessed with tragedy. I think ultimately we're rubbernecking. Like we're scared for threats for us. And that's why we binge true crime and cult documentaries. But I too am absolutely obsessed with Heaven's Gate and did interview a lot of experts about it, including a survivor of Heaven's Gate. And my approach in interviewing him was definitely delicate, but he was so open and so generous. And you know, had obviously had fascinating insights on the group and has been out of it. I mean, that was 1997 when that happened. So he's had some distance from it and is able to reflect on it in very level way. Like I didn't feel like I was dealing with someone who was just recently traumatized or something like that. Like I was able to have, you know, a very human conversation with him.
I suppose because of the likes of you and me as well, he's probably had that conversation a good few times by this point.
Although what was really cool is that like I talked to so many sources for this book who've obviously had to repeat their story about their cult experience so many times. But what was really validating for me was that almost every single source I talked to said something along the lines of, I've had to tell this story so many times, but never like this, because no one ever asks them about the language. People are just like, oh my God. And then what happened? And then what happened? Oh my God, you did that. Mm-hmm. And nobody's really getting to like the social science, the psychology, the linguistics. People don't really dig deep because they're distracted by the flashy cult iconography and the weird behaviors and the outfits. And they're never really digging deep to find out what actually happened here.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier on that you have a background in linguistics, and I recently watched the Nexium documentary where they talk about neuro-linguistic programming. So I didn't know if there was a part in your book where those two things kind of come together, because I know a lot of it is to do with body language as well as the words that are being spoken and the rhythms and things like that. But I don't know if it was something that would overlap with your kind of two different worlds.
I mean, neuro-linguistic programming is pseudoscience, like it's not real, and I looked into it a little bit, but it's actually like the least interesting thing I've ever read about. It's like a bunch of mumbo jumbo bullshit, and groups like Nexium and Scientology and other like new age groups run by these like egomaniac guys who claim to be geniuses. What they do is they basically co-opt a lot of terms from technical fields like linguistics, software engineering, biology, stuff like that. And they'll like twist the very legit sounding vernacular, even though they have no background in these subjects, or maybe they're trafficking in a field of pseudoscience like neuro-linguistic programming. So yeah, I looked into NLP or whatever a little bit, but ultimately, like, it's not a real tool of manipulation. Like, it's just another, like, garbage red herring to make people think that they're doing something to help their self-actualization. But really what's going on are, like, these other techniques. And neuro-linguistic programming is just, like, this garbage that isn't real.
That's still interesting to hear that from you know, somebody that has a background in linguistics and kind of would know the answer to that question.
Like, not real. Like, no actual linguist would be like, oh, neuro-linguistic programming. Yes, I'm a scholar of that. It's like, no, some fucking like new age self-help blowhards in the 70s made this shit up, slapped a technical sounding term on it to distract people and
from the real language that's being used.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you have any future book plans, or is it too soon to be thinking about kind of churning out another good read?
Oh, it's never too soon. It's never too soon. I am in the early stages of putting together a third book. It's a co-authored project, and I don't want to spill too much about it, but it's sort of true crime meets memoir meets cultural criticism about an Instagram grifter. And it's pretty fun to be working on so far.
That sounds so interesting. And it was actually what you said earlier about trying to create a juicy book that kind of has all the information in, but is also digestible. I feel that's what a really good memoir does as well. They kind of, it feels like you're reading a novel, but it's someone's story and they have the juicy bits in there, but they also have the like, and these are the methods of coercion that were used. And you're like, oh yes, this is a book about being in a cult. I forgot while you were telling me about your childhood, but now let's get into that side of things as well. So that's that was a nice comparison that I drew when you were talking about the review that you got left on your Goodreads account. So amazing. So before we finish, Amanda, would you just like to tell everybody again the dates of when your book is released, what the full title is, and where they can find it?
Of course. Well, people can buy Word Slut, A Feminist Guide to Taking Back the English Language, my first book, now wherever books are sold, also an ebook, audiobook. I recorded it myself, all that good stuff. And then Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism will be published in the US on June 15th. In the UK in July, I believe on July 22nd. And in the meantime, if you want your cultish fix, you can follow me on Instagram at Amanda_Montel, where I post a lot of fun culty content.
Is there an option to pre-order your book at the moment?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, I would love for people to pre-order Cultish. And you can also do that wherever books are sold. Your local independent bookstore will be able to pre-order it for you. Oh, and keep an eye out for my forthcoming podcast, Sounds Like a Cult is the name of it.
Yes, I'm definitely going to put a pre-order link in the episode description, but also keep an eye on Sounds Like a Cult podcast so that I can do some shouting out of that when it's released as well, because us podcasters all have to stick together and promote each other's material. So I will definitely mention that on the episode as well. So thank you so much, Amanda, for coming and joining us today. I wish you the best of luck with your book release. I hope you have a really fun time around launch time. That's when lockdown lifts over here as well. So if you were in the UK, a little tour, and you'd be able to visit the libraries and bookshops finally.
I would love that. I truly would love that. So hopefully, you know, once it's safe, I'll be able to travel about and meet my fellow cult curious bookworms.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Okay, Amanda, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Thanks. Bye.
That is the end of this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod or at www.cultvaultpodcast.com. I'm your speaker, Casey, and this has been The Cult Vault.